Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Facebook is pulling another tweak of your feed, preparing to see more posts from real people, that is family and friends, and fewer posts from news organizations, businesses, and even public radio shows. Slate's senior technology writer, Will Oramus, has been writing about the change. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Thanks for having me.
So Facebook is making changes to its news feed algorithm fairly often, it seems like, these days. What's going on?
Yeah, they're always changing it. It's been constantly evolving over the past several years. And the reason is this is a really hard problem for them to figure out. When you log into Facebook, you know, there are all your friends and all the pages you follow, all the events and groups. There are over 1,000 possible posts they could show you at the top of your feed. And that algorithm is in charge of figuring out which ones to show you first and which ones to put, you know, way down the list so that you'll probably never see them. That's a very difficult job. And they're always adding new sources of data collection, you know, figuring out how you use Facebook, what things you like and click on. They've also been working to add a lot of user surveys lately. So they are actually doing focus groups with users across the country and around the world. They are now putting surveys that will pop up on your feed when you log in, and they're asking you questions. So they want to know not only how are you using Facebook, but how do you feel about it? What do you want to see more of? What do you want to see less of? And one of the things that they found recently was consistently when they ask users, what types of posts would you like to see more of in your Facebook feed? Users are saying, well, I want to see more from my friends and family. And so the latest algorithm change is a pretty direct response to that. What it will do is it means that you'll see fewer posts relatively from pages you follow. So if you follow Slate.com on Facebook or if you follow WOSU, you will see fewer of our posts in your feed and you'll see a little bit more from the people, the individual people that you actually know.
And is this regardless of paid advertising on Facebook?
Yes, this is independent of advertising. So a lot of people don't realize this, but there is actually they're two separate things. One algorithm ranks all the posts that you could see in your feed that are not advertising. And then there's another algorithm that's going to serve you a certain number of advertisements sandwiched in between those normal posts. So they're two different things, and one does not directly affect the other.
Facebook released a statement of values to help explain its mission and its purpose. And I was wondering, has that been a statement of values that has been around for a long time or what?
Yeah, so this is interesting. Facebook is not under any particular obligation to explain why its algorithm works the way it does. But I think it has the impression that people feel like it's mysterious. They feel like it's maybe a little creepy or maybe evil, or maybe it's just they feel like it doesn't do its job very well, or maybe they're worried. There was a big dust-up recently because an ex-contractor at Facebook had accused some of his colleagues who worked on a feature called the trending news feature, of letting their liberal political bias seep into the stories they chose. Now, that was a different feature than the main news feed, but still, I think a lot of people probably got the impression from the news that Facebook might have political biases that are built into what you see when you log into the app. So I think this is a response to that on Facebook's part. They want to be a little bit more transparent, or at least give the impression of more transparency, so that people don't, you know, people feel like they understand where Facebook's coming from in building this very influential algorithm that sorts all the posts you see in your feed. So in this case, they actually released what they called a statement of values, and they listed seven values that they aim for in the newsfeed algorithm. And at the very top, and this was not by accident, they really think this is the most important, at the very top was putting your friends and family first.
Why is that important, a distinction for Facebook? It seems sort of obvious, but
I know, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, you know, the values that they put on this list are pretty obvious. You know, none of them, you're not going to look at any of them and be like, oh my goodness, that's the real secret to what.
Yeah, eureka, right.
Right, no, it's pretty anodyne. But there is some significance in them putting friends and family first, and especially since they released this values statement at the same time that they came out with this algorithm change that will show you more posts from your friends and family. I think it's Facebook trying to get back to its roots. You know, over the years, it has gone from a really, truly social network where you would interact just with your friends and people you know to something much bigger and more complex. And it's now, in a lot of ways, for a lot of users, it's become sort of a, you know, like the morning newspaper. You know, not everybody reads the print newspaper anymore, but people log into Facebook to see what's going on in the world. So it's become sort of a news feed as well. There are live videos on there now. There are articles. There are, you know, there's all kinds of jokes and entertaining content, viral chain letters, that kind of stuff. And Facebook, I think, is worried that it's losing some of the personal dimension to its service. This was highlighted fairly recently when a report in Gizmodo, the tech blog, said that there was leaked data from within Facebook where they were seeing a decline in what they called original sharing or personal sharing. So that means that Facebook users are just as engaged as they've always been, but they're sharing more stuff that's like a link to an article or a link to a funny comic, and less stuff that's about themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, so less of their own thoughts about their lives and the world or their photos from last night. And Facebook is really worried about that. They don't want to just become this sterile environment where people share links to news articles. They really want to keep that social dimension, and I think that's what this is about.
Hasn't that changed? Though, been a function and part of Facebook's effort to monetize itself?
Yeah, I think that is part of it. You know, Facebook wants to be, it's funny, you know, when these values came out, I published my story and posted it on Twitter, and somebody replied on Twitter. They were looking at the value statement, and they said, oh, so Facebook just wants to be all things to all people. What's so hard to understand about
mm-hmm.
that?
Yeah.
You know, it really does. It wants to be everything. It wants to be your news source.
It
wants
to be
the way you connect. Yeah, and you know, it, to some extent it can be, just because people, the sheer amount of time that people spend on there and the sheer volume of users is so great that it really can do a lot. But it can't do everything. And, you know, monetizing is, for Facebook, is really... There are a number of revenue streams, but the biggest one are those ads that you see in the news feed. So you're scrolling through your feed, refreshing, seeing posts from friends and family and articles, and you see an ad in there. And so the more different types of content they have in there, the more they can make Facebook something that you spend a long time on every day, the more of those ads you'll see. So when you think about Facebook trying to make money, you know, it's easy to think in the short term, oh, they're trying to, you know, maybe they're trying to make this change so that publishers, media publishers, will have to buy ads if they want people to see their stories. Well, that would be pretty short-sighted on Facebook's part to, you know, to not show users what they want in service of trying to get media publishers to buy more ads. What they're really trying to do, I believe this, it's in their self-interest, they are looking at the long view. They want to keep people coming back to the site. So when they decide that you're going to see fewer posts from media publishers, that's not because they're trying to put the squeeze on media publishers, I don't think. It's really because that's what users have told them they want to see, and they live in sort of perpetual fear of giving users what they don't want and then losing those users, because that's really, losing users long term is really the only threat to this massive money minting machine that Facebook has become.
It's been an issue for nonprofits, say like WOSU, though, that can't afford the kind of advertising that, you know, for-profits can do, but then are getting shoved back in terms of the posts and how they rank.
Yeah, it's, and just because I don't think Facebook is doing this out of an evil conspiracy to squeeze publishers for money, does not mean that publishers and nonprofits and other organizations that have Facebook pages aren't right to be really frustrated. They are. You know, Facebook has over time it has encouraged everybody from nonprofits to media organizations to brands, corporate brands, to make these Facebook pages and to get people to sign up. I don't know if you remember, you know, if your listeners remember 3 or 4 years ago, every company would be trying to get you to sign up for their Facebook page and follow their Facebook page, because Facebook had told them, well, this is a way to reach people on our service, is get people to follow your page. Well, then, you know, a year or so later, everybody was getting all these posts from, you know, United Airlines and, you know, I don't, Jiffy Peanut Butter in their feed, and it turned out they hated it. They didn't really, you know, you might have been coerced into following some brand's Facebook page, but you didn't really want to see their posts over a post from your best friend about, you know, their engagement. And so Facebook backtracked and then sort of tuned down those posts from pages. Nowadays, you hardly ever see any of them in your feed. That's enormously frustrating to those companies that expended all that effort to get people to sign up for their pages. And now we're seeing something somewhat similar. I don't think it'll be quite as catastrophic as it was for brands, but we're seeing something similar with publishers and other organizations that actually publish content that people like. Even they are going to be less prominent in people's feeds nowadays. And they're going to have to find other ways to reach their constituencies.
Is this whole friend thing that's going on Facebook right now, where they look back over the past 5 years of your best friend with your best friend, and who may be your cat for all you know, but is that part of this whole thing?
You know, yes and no. So that, as I understand it, is not, you know, that wasn't an algorithm change. There are features that Facebook has all the time where they're trying to emphasize something that you like about the site, or give you a new way to look back over your history on the site. They do, you know, they do those year-end
right
montages where you can look back at your year-end photos or Facebook posts or that kind of thing. Those are just, you know, those are all just ways to try to deepen the connection that you have with Facebook and to make you feel like, you know, Facebook knows you, knows what you like, and knows your interests. That's a little different from when they tweak the algorithm to change the criteria by which they rank different types of posts. But I do think there's a similar goal here, in that Facebook recognizes its biggest edge is not having all these media publishers on it. Its biggest edge over all its competitors is the actual social network that you have, that network of friends that you've built up over the years. And Facebook's data that they have on your connections and who you like interacting with and who you like following, that's really what sets them apart from the Twitters and Snapchats and other social media entities out there. And I think they really are trying to leverage that and capitalize on that as much as possible.
The second list in the statement of values is that your feed should inform, and Facebook wants to be a destination for news, like you said. As usual, it wants to be all things to all people, but that seems directly contrary to the first value.
To inform, you're saying that the second value of to inform is contrary to the first value of putting friends and family first.
Kinda.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I don't know if they're contrary. I think they are. Maybe, you know, they're at different, slightly different angles.
Yeah.
So Facebook is not going to, this is a point that was easily lost, I think, in the latest algorithm shuffle. They're not going to stop showing you news stories. It's just that now you're more likely to see news stories that your friends are sharing rather than news stories that are posted directly by the news organization that created them. So you could still see a post from WOSU or Slate in your feed. I mean, you could still see it from WOSU or Slate. They're not getting rid of that entirely. If you follow one of those organizations, you'll still see their stuff in your feed, maybe just marginally less than before. But you will not see any less of like a Slate post that your friend thought was interesting and decided to share on Facebook. In fact, you'll see a little more of that. So you can still go to Facebook to be informed, but you probably, I mean, it's true, you probably will see, as a result of this change, a little bit more of pets and babies and vacations.
Yeah, because it's going to be a function more of what your friends are posting, and if they're
exactly
into pets and babies, that's
exactly
what you're going to see.
Exactly. But if your friends, you know, if your friends are real news hounds, and you are too, then you'll still see a lot of news in your feed. You're just going to see the news that your friends are sharing a little more than the news that the organizations you follow are sharing.
How much control will users have? Because the news feed in Facebook is customizable. What does that mean?
Yeah. So I found this kind of amusing. I don't know if anybody else did, but they had seven values, and they weren't in strict order, except the first three were in order. So we talked about number one, which is friends and family first. We talked about number two, which is to inform. Number three is to entertain. And I thought it was a little interesting that to entertain comes below to inform for Facebook, because I would guess, I know a lot of people go there to get information, but I would guess the average Facebook user goes there to be entertained, probably more than informed. But Facebook really, you know, they like to see themselves as this influential news platform, in addition to just a place to see, you know, quizzes about which, you know, which Downton Abbey character you are, that sort of thing. One of the values further down the list was the ability, was giving you control over your own feed. I thought it was funny. They had this second to last, and I think that's about where Facebook places, you know, that's about in accordance with the importance Facebook places on this. Facebook, from the start, you know, they've always given you a little bit of control over your feed, and they've given you more over time, actually. But all along, Facebook has been convinced that the way to show people interesting stuff on a huge scale, you know, when you have 1.5 billion users, as Facebook does today, the way to show them interesting stuff is to do it automatically, is to have this super complicated, sophisticated algorithm that will decide what everybody sees. They've always believed that if you make users have too much control, or if you make them customize their own feed too much, it's going to feel like a lot of work for them. You know, we might all feel like we want control over what we see in our feeds, but if you tell us to sit down and spend 2 hours, you know, tweaking all the criteria, how many of us are really going to take the time to do that? And then if we don't do that, we're going to get crummy feeds, we're not going to look at anything, and we're going to leave the site. Uh-huh. So at least that's Facebook's view. They really do think that, you know, most people are better off sticking with Facebook's algorithm, which probably knows them. I don't know if it knows them better than they know themselves, but it knows them better than they would probably care to take the time to customize for themselves.
Well, Will Aramis, thanks for joining us again, as usual, for to help us digest all of this.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That's Will Aramis. He is senior tech writer for Slate Magazine. We'll post a link to his report about the changes ahead in your Facebook feed. Coming up on Tech Tuesday, the role or not of Internet access in the spread of democracy. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Many internet aficionados fancy the idea that internet access is a prime force in the spread of modern democracy. That may not be the case. Instead, the internet may distance people from politics, from the fundamentals of democracy. Ohio State University communications professor Eric Nisbet has published a new study that suggests that the internet can reinforce change, but not necessarily drive it. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Eric Nisbet.
Thank you for having me here today.
Where did the idea that the internet promotes democracy come from?
Well, it's been around for a long time, even going back to the birth of the internet. And when it started out becoming popular in the United States, people thought it would give people who were disenfranchised, people who didn't have access to information, who did not participate in politics in the United States, to enrich our democracy. And then it sort of gained a lot of force in 2011 with the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement in the United States. You had protests somewhat internet-driven in Brazil. And so the idea that worldwide that the internet can be a force of democracy is beginning gaining steam for a while.
Was it the internet or was it social media?
Well, the conversation was first around the internet before, you know, social media became popular. And now the focus has been on both. Both offer information tools for citizens globally, whether it's news websites, access to foreign media outside of your own country, as well as then social media that might be peer-driven and access to citizen journalism, information that not necessarily controlled by your government.
So tell us about your study. What did you look at and what did you measure?
Well, this study was focused on Russia and Ukraine in particular, one country that's known for its authoritarian governance and one that's sort of a troubled democracy at best in Ukraine. And what we wanted to see is sort of deconstruct and looking at the user perspective, how people are using the internet, and does how people use the internet matter for what we consider certain key democratic outcomes, being able to assess how the quality of democracy in your country, how much democracy you actually have, the supply of democracy, if you will, as well as how did it impact your support for the governing regime, whether it's the Putin regime or the Ukrainian government, as well as then how did it impact your demand for democracy? How much democracy do you want? Because those two things are key for democratization, both here in the United States as well as overseas. You need to value democracy, want democracy, but you also need to have sort of an accurate perception of how much democracy you have. And what you often see that motivates people is when they see a deficit, a disconnect between how much I want and how much I need, all right, and how much I have. So
and how much they can have.
But the key thing first is, do people actually have an accurate perception of how much democracy they have? And you look at countries like Russia and you look at the polling beyond our own survey, and Russians believe, compared to all outside experts, both political and otherwise, that an academic, that they have much more democracy than they actually enjoy. Part of our question, what drives that? And in a country like Russia, what you have is, you know, this push ever since there was anti-Putin protests in 2011, 2012, you've had the government cracking down on the internet because they see it as an alternative source of information that gives people a more accurate window and mirror to their own country.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the relationship between the internet and the spread of democracy around the world. My guest is Eric Nisbet. He's an associate professor in the School of Communication at Ohio State, and he's done research on this issue. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. One thing we've learned, particularly since Arab Spring, is how easily countries or governments can shut off the internet.
Yes, they can shut it off, but that also creates a backlash.
Yeah.
And in a separate survey that that I was part of, a project a couple years ago, they looked at what reasons would Russians protest in terms of any types of limitations to the internet rights. And the only reason that really got people upset was if they turned off the internet in general. And you actually saw some of the largest protests people turned to in Egypt were after the internet was actually turned off, mm-hmm. because people had nothing to do, right? People who might not otherwise protest were upset that their cat videos were turned off. Mm-hmm. So what a lot of governments have been doing, Russia, Turkey, other China, you know, various different ways, have been not necessarily turning the internet off, but they've been focusing on different ways to censor the internet. Some ways are legal and political and technical. Others are what I call psychological.
Like what's that?
Well, I call it the psychological firewall. The idea is that, you know, there's this threat rhetoric, the idea that the internet threatens you in some way, and thus we need to censor it for your own good. Right. We won't take away your entertainment options, but we'll take away your information options, because those information options might lead to political instability or being used by foreign governments against you.
And do people fall for that?
Oh, yes. Well, polling in both Russia and Turkey to a lesser extent has shown that a lot of people buy into these threat perceptions. I mean, Putin is a very popular president in Russia. The government is popular ever since the Crimean conflict. Erdogan in Turkey also is popular among a plurality, if not majority, of Turks. And so, you know, people who tend to, just like the United States, those who have strong political orientations, whether Democrat or Republican, will basically sort of process information in a biased way and basically listen to the relevant political leaders. So you see the same thing in these countries where people view how much democracy they have in a very biased manner. If I'm a Putin supporter, I believe I have more democracy. If I'm an Erdogan supporter in Turkey, I believe I have more democracy. And I believe them when they tell me the internet is a threat to me. So I support their internet censorship efforts.
Interesting. Are there opposition groups in those countries?
Well, that's
that
a difference.
Try to fight against that.
They are, and I mean that's a big sort of contextual difference between Turkey and Russia. Even though Turkey has its difficulties with democracy, and President Erdogan has taken a more authoritarian turn, in Turkey there is a much more vibrant and outspoken political opposition. Has very vibrant and strong in the parliament, even though it's a minority, and so there is less support for this perspective, less support for internet censorship in Turkey compared to Russia, where there's a very tame opposition at best, or very little opposition. You also have – so you have more diversity of – more political diversity and pluralism in Turkey, even though it's limited, does create a difference in terms of at least providing a counter narrative on why internet censorship is a bad thing, that the internet doesn't threaten you, and that you should protect your rights.
In countries where they censor the internet, how much does that play into social media?
Plays a lot into social media, you know. In
so I know I'm not going to get a certain number of things on my feed when I Google
right.
something, but
for example,
what if I'm
Turkey,
on Facebook?
Well, in Turkey, for example, there is a law against insulting a public official, right? Which is something that we would not understand in the United States, but it's a law in Turkey. And the president of Turkey, Erdogan, regularly goes after, and the government prosecutes journalists, former beauty queens, a 14-year-old boy, right? Anyone who might have posted something that was even appeared derogatory towards the president, either on Twitter or Facebook.
And this is socially acceptable.
It's not necessarily – well, it's socially acceptable possibly among supporters of President Erdogan,
yeah.
But against opposition. But the problem is it's not socially acceptable. It's legally acceptable.
Right.
I mean this is a law on the books that prosecutors regularly – actually, if you look at all the countries in the world, and Turkey by far is not the most democratic, not the least democratic. It's somewhere mm-hmm. in between, right? It is actually has the largest number of Twitter removal requests by a very large number in the world each year. So it basically is very active, the government going to Twitter, going to the company and telling to remove certain content they deem either offensive or against their national security interests.
And how complicit is Twitter and Facebook and so on in this?
Well, Twitter wants to do business. I mean, Twitter, Twitter and Facebook, for example, in Turkey at least, are it's a huge market for them. I think Turkey is the seventh largest market for Facebook globally.
Wow.
About 40% of Turkish internet users are on Twitter. So, based upon some of our polling, so those are big markets. They have to play ball. You know, just like Google censors itself in China, social media to be present in some of these countries. Russia's a different story. But Russia has taken a different tack in terms of trying to limit the democratic potential of social media by really promoting what they call the Rusnet, right? So where you find that Facebook and Twitter are not very popular social media channels in Russia compared to domestic Russian-created social media platforms. And Russia, as a government, has much more control over these domestic platforms than international companies like Facebook or Twitter.
People, we already know this, have a tendency to look at things that reinforce their pre-existing views. How does that fit into this research?
Well, people are going to be driven by what they're interested in. So if I go to the internet for entertainment purposes, I'm going to seek out entertainment content. If I go to the internet for what we call capital building purposes, either talking about politics with others or seeking out news, I'm going to focus on that. So obviously there's what we call selective exposure aspect to this. But what we're saying is above and beyond that, the how you use the internet, if you come across information that challenges your worldview. That's why your last segment was also so important about Facebook, right?
Yeah.
If you come across information that challenges your view, political information, news information, talk to someone with a different political perspective, that can have meaningful democratic consequences in terms of making you more aware of what's going on in your country, more aware of how democracy works in other countries so you can compare your country to other countries. That's important. And so when you see social media creating bubbles, right? That has important consequences for the health of democracy, whether it's in Russia or the United States. The other thing you have is, you know, what's going on with the internet is very similar to what people have looked at the same type of historical development of television.
Okay.
In that, Marcus Pryor is a scholar at Princeton, calls it the post-broadcast democracy. Back in the 50s and 60s, when there were only three different TV channels, you couldn't help but be exposed to news. There was nothing else on at 6:30 at night, 6
change
o'clock.
Change the channel. No.
Right. Even if you change the channel, you're exposed to what we call incidental information, right. Political information. People are more informed. They had less choice. Mm-hmm. What we find is the more choice you have for media and entertainment options, the less informed the people become. And that's the same for the internet with now streaming, you know, streaming options, YouTube Red. You know, you can watch cat videos all day and pay for premium cat videos, and you don't have to ever pay attention to politics. And that's part of the problem, in that when we look at the growth of the internet overseas, right, especially in countries like Russia, used to be only had a few options, right, and maybe only had foreign media sources, because domestic media that was controlled by the Russian government didn't have very sophisticated web presence. But as that increases, you now have choices to selectively expose yourself into information and be less exposed to dissonant information.
It sort of cracks me up, because some of the first YouTube videos I ever watched were political. They were jib-jab.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's probably partly because of your own interests.
Partly, but back – yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, how – so what do we know about how political organizations should treat the internet? How do they manage it?
Well, I think what you're seeing is something similar to the strategies when you had more and more TV channels. That's why I had Bill Clinton go on the Arsenio Hall show and play the saxophone, right?
Yeah.
The politicians started migrating where the viewers were on TV. And
Comedy Central
on Ellen, right? And where you see a lot of political organizations go online is try to create political satire, political entertainment online. I think that's the next generation, as people are more focusing on using the internet as another tool of entertainment. You'll see that you need to infiltrate those entertainment options with political messages. I mean, look at our presidential election this year. You have a reality star who built up his visibility in TV entertainment, but at the same time, he created this quite a social media presence. They
Unreal.
Call him the first social 16 million Twitter followers, right?
Yeah.
Well, those Twitter followers didn't come after he started running. They came before, right? And now he has a channel of communication that, compared to Mitt Romney in 2012, where people have to – you're talking about Diane Rehm, like, give him a shout out this morning about how, you know, 20 different people had to approve each one of Romney's tweets back in 2012. Yeah. You have someone who can actually use that as a communication channel, and it blends entertainment and politics very, very neatly.
Well, Eric Nisbet, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great.
Eric Nisbet is associate professor in the School of Communications at OSU. We'll post a link to his article in the Journal of Communications on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up on Tech Tuesday, a new virtual reality experience for Ghostbuster fans. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher, and that, of course, is the inimitable theme music from the first Ghostbusters movie released in 1984. A sequel in 1989 and a remake of the original this year have continued to stoke interest in that franchise. Now there's a new virtual reality experience out there. It's called Ghostbusters Dimension. Joining us for a weekly chat about VR and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So could you give us an overview of what Ghostbusters Dimension is all about?
Absolutely. This is the kind of cherry on top to a new exhibit that is open at Madame Tussauds in New York right now. And it's not like a virtual reality experience that you can just kind of have at home. This is a very specific kind of tour that you take, where you put on the virtual reality headset and a special vest, and you hold a gun that looks kind of like the blaster used on proton packs as Ghostbusters, and you walk through this tour basically, and you and the people that you are with on that tour, you know, shoot ghosts as they come at you, and complete a Ghostbuster story as though you were one of the main characters.
What kind of technology goes into this virtual reality experience? Is it new?
Well, some of it is new, and some of it is what you can use at home right now. It uses a headset that's not dissimilar from the HTC Vive or Oculus Rift in that it's, you know, something that, you know, fills your field of vision and has headphones that you put on. But instead of connecting to an existing computer somewhere, it actually connects to a backpack that has what's basically a laptop in it. And part of that backpack is this vest that comes around, and the vest has these vibration motors all across it, so that when you are hit with something in the virtual reality environment, you actually feel it in your chest. You feel those vibration motors go off.
It's the first time a developer has tracked an actual weapon in VR, and I guess I'm sort of surprised to hear that, and I'm wondering what it means for first-person shooter games.
Well, so there have been a couple of examples of this kind of technology having been used before. Sony, for example, has an accessory that's coming out in October for the PlayStation VR, where you're going to be able to do something very similar. But yeah, there's a physical thing that you hold in your hand that occupies both hands as though you are holding a rifle that you can, you know, pull the trigger on. And when you have the headset on, you can look down and see, you know, how much ammunition you have and, you know, or rather how much energy you have in this situation. And when you point it, you know, around in the room, then it points in the game as well. And it really kind of adds to that immersion when you pull the trigger and you feel kind of the kickback from you know, from the trigger being pulled as though you were holding an actual weapon.
Yeah, is that hyper-real world they're talking about?
So a big part of what they're considering hyper-reality is you know, these introduction the introduction of real-world elements. And as silly as the name sounds, there was some really impressive aspects. You know, walking through a room, there was this big monster that came out and kind of ripped away a part of the wall to the room that I was standing in. And as my eyes saw the wall being ripped away and I could see the outside world, you know, cool air that was noticeably cooler than the room was at the time hit me like a fan from somewhere that was blowing cooler air. So it felt like, you know, the outside air was rushing in to hit me as though, you know, that were real. And you know, another example, you know, kind of the most popular bad guy in all of the Ghostbusters world, you know, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. you shoot him at the end of this experience, and when you and your partners take him down, the entire room then smells like toasted marshmallows as it explodes. So it's just really bizarre to have these kind of real world things, you know, because the whole point is you're walking through this and your brain is constantly saying, I know this isn't real, but it's really cool, but I know this isn't real. And that kind of rush of cool air when you know, you expect it in the virtual world and the smell associated with what would happen in the virtual world, it really kind of messes with you a little bit, and it takes away that assurance that what you're seeing isn't real.
What's it like to be doing this with other people?
Well, so they did a really good job. The company behind all of this technology is called The Void. And they've done a really good job with you know, tracking and the use of microphones and headphones, so that, you know, you're walking through the room together, and I can turn and see, you know, a virtual representation of my partner in a Ghostbusters outfit, you know, complete with a headset for you know, seeing ghosts. And when I speak, that person can hear me in their headphones, and I can hear them when they speak in my headphones. So even though we're wearing big headphones, we can hear each other as though we're, you know, unobstructed by anything. And so it really does. It adds a compelling element. And because you can see the kind of physical representation of the person in the game, you're unlikely to, you know, bump into them or kick them and knock them over, now, unless you, you know, wanted to.
Have you done this?
We did, yeah. Me and two of my colleagues went up to New York last week as they were unveiling it, and took a tour of the new Ghostbusters exhibit at Madame Tussauds, and then tried this virtual reality experience at the end, and it was phenomenal. I mean, it was well and truly above any virtual reality experience I've had so far.
Oh my God, that's saying a lot. All right, so what's it gonna cost?
Well, it's part of the Madame Tussauds experience, so it's going to be an additional cost on top of the normal price of admission ticket, which at that facility is $37 for access to the entire facility. And then I don't know yet what the additional charge is going to be for this, but I can't imagine it being more than, you know, another $10 or $15.
And the room that you walk through, you were talking about how it's mapped out one-to-one in virtual reality beforehand to make the experience immersive. How were they able to do it? So if you're seeing like the Stay Puft, whatever the guy is, the marshmallow guy, knocking down the wall, what is someone else seeing? Same thing?
Well, for that particular experience, it's just a great big gray wall that you would see in the real world. But, you know, the very first room that you walk into in this game, you walk in and it's an apartment, you know, and you see a television and a couch and a bookshelf and things like that. And if you reach out and, you know, touch the television, there's a box there that is the same shape and size as the television. So it feels like it's actually there. And if you go to sit down on the couch, the couch is actually there. So you feel, you know, the couch cushions as you go to sit down on them. And it's really impressive, you know, how much that adds to the experience. You know, there's a scaffolding that you walk out on in the game. And I'm sure that in the real world, this is just, you know, a set of rolling casters and some wood and a railing. But to see your body kind of hanging over a side of a building on a scaffolding and take a step and have the entire environment around you wobble in real life as though you're on an actual scaffolding is really alarming.
Yeah. What do you see this technology being applied to in other ways besides Harry Potter? I mean, you know, we all want to fly in a broom.
That's the big thing. Yeah, I think that's the big thing here is that this is kind of the, for lack of a better term, this is the amusement park grade, you know, experience. And, you know, the expectation there is when you go to, you know, a special experience like, you know, Madame Tussauds or an amusement park or something like that, you expect that experience to be, you know, just a you know, head and shoulders above what you would then go home and do. You know, so the, you know, an amusement park ride or you know, a special kind of video game that you would go and play. The virtual reality setups that we have at home now that you can have at home are still kind of expensive, but are you know, very much, you know, from a technical perspective, similar to what you would get if you went to, you know, a virtual reality arcade, you know, 3 or 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And so this is kind of that step above by making the environment itself as real as possible when you're walking through with this hardware. And that's obviously something you're not going to be able to do at home. You're not going to convert, you know, an entire room in your house to feel like one particular experience when the idea is that you can play a whole bunch of experiences when you're at home.
Are you surprised at all that like the amusement parks didn't get to this first before something like Madame Tussauds?
I think that, you know, the big thing right now with virtual reality is that it's there's such a stigma from, you know, 10 and 15 years ago when it wasn't very good and it caused a nausea in, you know, places where it wasn't delivered, you know, properly.
Mm-hmm.
There have been examples over the last year of amusement parks taking virtual reality steps. Six Flags, for example, has a special virtual reality ride at a couple of their parks now, mm-hmm. where you put a virtual reality headset on and get on a roller coaster.
Okay.
And the virtual reality ride is very, very, you know, different from obviously just sitting on the roller coaster and watching the environment fly around you. But, you know, some people are you know, still very sensitive to that kind of thing when you're moving as fast as you would be on a roller coaster.
Yeah.
So it's there are still some challenges there.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, that's our virtual reality segment for this week. Moving on. In other reality merging news, Pokemon Go is coming soon to Android and iOS. And first of all, can you explain the Pokemon brand for those who have been living in a cave for the last 20 years?
Sure. Yeah. So this was a game that came out, like you said, right around 20 years ago, actually exactly 20 years ago. And the whole purpose was to create this kind of long-term game where you had, monsters that you would capture and then battle against other people who had similar monsters. And it created a really kind of a global craze as people of just about every age would work to, accomplish these goals and be the best of the person who could capture as many of these things as possible.
And there was just a big get-together of Pokemon, players in Columbus. But what's the difference between Pokemon Go and, the Pokemon where you're sitting down with the cards in front of you?
Well, so there's a couple of differences. This is actually the first time that a Pokemon game of any kind has been released on something that wasn't either a card game or controlled by Nintendo. And that increases the amount of people who can play dramatically because it's now available on every iPhone and every Android phone, or it will be when it comes out, to go and play this game. And the mechanics of the game are a little different. So the idea is you walk to a physical place in the real world, like a park or a statue, in a walkway or something like that. And in those places, you'll be able to interact with elements in the game, but you have to physically go to those places in order to do those things. So it's a game that, directly encourages you to kind of get out and walk around and do things. And as you do that, you can walk, a half mile. And as you're walking, Pokemon in the game, in those kind of designated spaces, will reach out and interact with you. And you can choose to capture them or take them to places across the world that have been designated as gyms and use them to fight other people.
This reminds me sort of like of geocaching and that sort of thing.
It does have elements in geocaching. There was another game made by the same company who's helping the Pokemon company with this called Ingress. That's been out for a little while now. And it's very much, getting out and exploring the real world while playing this game and interacting with, landmarks that are, in real spaces around you. And it's really kind of fascinating to see people play this game and the Ingress game before it, because it really does kind of encourage people to map out, a pretty significant chunk of land across the day that they would go and just kind of, like tour downtown Columbus, for example, and go to all of these spots. Not just to play the game, but also to kind of experience those places that they wouldn't have normally decided to go and just walk around on a Saturday.
And just like the card game, this isn't just for kids, right?
No, this is very much for, any age. And the game is really kind of compelling in the amount of energy you put into it. It is not necessarily a representation of, the amount of money you have or the amount of time that you've spent. It's really kind of an interactive experience. So if you're into the game, if you're into the characters, it's really just, spend some time with the game and you'll have a lot more fun.
And then just one other thing, an article from TheVerge.com said that the game forces the user to grind in order to advance in the game. What does that mean? And what do you think about that notion?
Well, so unlike previous versions of the game, you have to acquire a certain number of items in order to upgrade your characters. In this game, it's called evolving. And the evolutionary process is a little different from previous Pokemon games and involves doing a fair bit of, walking around or, collecting accessories. I'm not sure that I would call it grinding, at least from my experience. There are, the more advanced Pokemon require more resources, which is true of just about any game that has that format in it. So it's really, it's not something that you can sit at home and do. And so I guess being more physically exertive probably feels a little more like grinding. You have to walk around, you could very well do this an hour a day every day and get something new out of it every single time you play it.
All right. And should kids be doing it alone? I mean, how does that work?
I mean, like anything, it's going to be dependent on your environment. And, you're kind of also presupposing that a child is going to have a smartphone to begin with.
Yeah.
So if someone is old enough to have a smartphone and old enough to walk around, that's going to be at the discretion of the parent.
Yeah,
I would think. But this isn't something I would let my kid go around and do alone until they were, 14 or 15.
Right. Right. Well, how soon is it coming out to Android and iOS?
It's going to be coming out later this summer.
Okay.
This is something we actually got to experience with the Pokemon Company over the last couple of weeks. They've given us a chance to take a look at it before it came out. And when it comes out, it's going to be available for everyone all at once.
Okay. Well, Russell Holly, as usual, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. Thanks for listening today. This has been Tech Tuesday, and this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.